Hi there. In this episode of Moving the Needle in Medicine, I sit down with Dr. Anu Lala, a leading expert in advanced heart failure and transplant, to discuss the moments, mentors, and decisions that helped define her remarkable career. From advancing research in heart failure and transplant medicine to shaping the next generation of cardiovascular specialists through her leadership and mentorship, Dr. Lala offers a fascinating look at how clinical innovation, research, and education come together to improve patient care. We explore lessons from leadership in academic medicine, the importance of mentorship, and what separates meaningful careers from impressive resumes. Whether you're interested in cardiology, research, leadership, or simply the journey behind a successful career in medicine, there's something here for you. Let's get started. Excited to be here today on Moving the Needle in Medicine. I have the pleasure to introduce my friend, mentor, and colleague, Dr. Anu Lala, who I've known for several years now. And we are excited to hear about your journey, hear about your story, and hopefully get some good tips of advice for life and medicine along the way. So without further ado, we'll jump right into it. And Anu, I'd love to hear about kind of your tell us about your origin story. How did you get to this point? What were the early, influences on your life and your career that got to this point?
Well, first of all, thank you, Alex. I'm really honored to be here. I'm following such incredible luminaries in our field. And, you know, also just kudos to you. I think your strong suit in, among so many others is really personal connection. And so it's really, it's wonderful to be here because I think as technology advances and we're seeing things move and progress at lightning pace, nothing's going to be able to take the place of human connection and interaction and inspiration. So really kudos to you and to HCP Live for doing this. And thank you for having me. So my origin story, my goodness. You know, I grew up sort of a regular Jersey Indian kid, moved around a bunch when I was younger, but then ultimately settled in North Jersey by the time I was like 10 or something like that. Very, very close family. I think that has been the defining force in my life. I deeply admire, respect, and am indebted to my parents and my brother for my childhood, for my upbringing, and for my sense of self that I think that they afforded. I think, you know, with respect to, we could go into so many different aspects of the origin story. I think also what will become more relevant potentially later during this conversation is how rooted I felt in our Indian culture, but also what that meant for us in terms of defining and developing our own kind of spiritual culture at home, which was really a huge part of us growing up. It wasn't about being Hindu or religion as much as it was developing our own personal sense of what it meant to have some sort of connection with whatever you want to call it. You know, the divine, the universe, whatever. And I think that also kept us closer as a family. My father is a cardiologist. And so I think, you know, probably the most pivotal part of the origin story, which I love that you've called it that, by the way, is when I was 12, much like Andrew being inspired by his grandfather, my grandmother was visiting from India, and I was very close to her. And one day after we were eating Pizza Hut, she loved Pizza Hut. It's probably not the best thing in retrospect.
Of course.
But she actually had an inferior MI. And I remember it very, like, so keenly. It was in our family room, and she had chest pain. It radiated down her left arm and to her jaw, and she vomited. And my father knew that she was having a heart attack, and he said, you know, we should take you to the hospital, like, you're having a heart attack. And she said, absolutely not. You know, she was, I think, in her early 80s at the time. She's like, I'm visiting here. I have no desire. If I have to go, I have to go, but I don't want to be in an American hospital in foreign kind of circumstances, and I want to stay here, and whatever happens, happens. So he said, okay, I'm going to treat you the way we used to treat MIs back in the day. You know, he went to his office, he brought a portable EKG machine home, he brought morphine and aspirin, and he treated her at home the way we used to in the old days, so to speak. And it was such a family affair. You know, obviously my mom was with her more from the emotional standpoint, but my brother and I were really kind of charged with also monitoring her, you know, like, and I remember distinctly, and I've talked about this before as well, my father saying, I want you to put your hand on her pulse, your fingers on her pulse. And in retrospect, he was probably like, I want to make, you know, make sure she's not braiding down, you know, and developing block or whatnot. But he was really deliberate about it. He was taking blood pressure every 15 minutes. And I was charged with putting my fingers on her pulse. And I remember, and it's so amazing how you can have these pivotal moments as a child where you know that you're a part of something that's life defining, but you're perhaps too young to kind of fully absorb it. But I knew that this was something pivotal that was happening. I was just so intensely moved by the fact that this pulse was sort of the rhythm of her life, and it was what we were monitoring and keeping such close tabs on. And I was really awed by how my father was taking care of her, how she ended up getting better, how she lived for several more years afterwards. And it was really something that stayed with me that I think about it even now. I actually am in my office. I'm going to show you this. I don't know for people who can listen, but this is a picture of me and my grandmother. And this is from my med school essay, my med school application essay. My brother actually made this for me for one of my birthdays. And the way it starts out is the pulse, the pulse, the pulse. I feel my grandmother's pulse in every patient's hand I'm blessed to encounter, reminding me of my passion for service and my love for the field of cardiovascular medicine.
Wow.
So, you know, and then the rest is history. I kind of was a little bit of a rebel actually growing up, and kind of got in trouble a bunch in high school and defied traditional norms and, you know, made my parents really crazy. I got class clown in high school, and, you know, it was kind of like, why did you get most likely to succeed, you know? I ended up going to Hopkins for undergrad, and that really kind of transformed me, where I sought out medicine, not because my parents wanted it, but because I wanted it. And I pursued it actually in secret. I thought I was going to be a creative writing major, and then realized it wasn't really for me. It was more something I wanted to do for me rather than as a pursuit for a career. And I met some of my best friends in that 4-year period, as most of us do. And then went to med school, met my husband, who has been a fierce advocate, like life coach, best friend along this journey. But it was always cardiology. Mm-hmm. So the rest kind of just flowed from there.
Yeah. It's so interesting you mentioned. I mean, that's a fantastic story. Thank you so much for sharing. How old were you when that all happened with your grandmother?
Yeah, I was 11 or 12.
Okay, yeah.
I can't remember exactly, but 11 or 12, yeah.
Definitely something that really molds and shapes you. And then, you know, you mentioned having the parents in medicine and things like that. You know, I think that my mom's a cardiologist. When I was talking with Jim Januzzi recently, you know, his father is in medicine as well. You know, there's interesting themes, because there's almost this predisposition towards like, oh, I was always going to be this. But I think everybody also has their other story of, you know, I found this path on my own, but it also was like helped that I had early exposure. And so maybe a little bit of chicken and the egg, but I think you said it the best. It was always cardiology. You know, I think that no matter what happened, you know, you'd find it would be something that happens that'll really just kind of solidify that path.
Yeah, I think that's such a, it's so important and also fun and gratifying to make it your own.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, and I there's not a day that I regret it.
So Hopkins for college, and then where did you do med school?
Yeah, I was at Rutgers for med school,
okay.
and that's where my husband, literally like on the first day of orientation.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, he's the best. And he's a gastroenterologist, and he always knew it was going to be GI. Super nerdy Indian couple. And yeah, then I was at Sinai for residency. I went to NYU for cardiology fellowship. And then I went to the Brigham for heart failure fellowship. And much like Andrew, that was the first ACGME accredited year. So I was Lynn Warner Stevenson's first ACGME fellow. And Mandeep Mehra had just gotten there at the time as well. So it was really such a great experience. At the time, I remember being enamored by my experience in the CCU, which we still hear so commonly today. In fact, it's oftentimes cited as one of the reasons we're potentially not seeing as many applicants in heart failure. And I had to kind of figure out what I wanted to do. And I was so happy that I made the decision that I made to pursue our field, because I think, of course, I love transplant, I love hemodynamics, but I think heart failure inherently forces you into deep relationships and deep connection and deep understanding of human nature at its most raw and vulnerable points in life. And I think there's something that really, really touches me about encountering a person when they are faced with, you know, life and death, quite literally. You know, I find ourselves in our field more than any other, perhaps, asking people like, what is your why? You know, what do you live for? And it sounds almost silly, trite, but it's real. And when you think about it, these are the questions that, you know, really define who we are. And so I really, really loved that exposure. I think on the surface is all the stuff that we all love, the hemodynamics, the exercise testing, the transplant, the VAD, the innovation, the pharmacotherapeutics, all of it. But what I really love at the core is meeting people where they are at their most raw and vulnerable selves. And I think the other part that I'd love to mention is that I'll never forget my first transplant run. In those days, we would go for the transplant runs because this was before DCD. And I remember seeing how a heart from an individual, like hypothetically speaking, you know, a female heart going into a male body, different color, race, different ethnicity, different belief systems. And yet when that heart enters that chest cavity, it beats just the same. And it almost makes you want to weep, you know, because that's really the essence of spirituality as well, right? It's oneness. It's understanding our inherent oneness and connection with each other. And so I think there's no more obvious example of our inherent oneness and how we're so much more similar than we are different than in heart transplantation. And I distinctly remember being in this operating room. I think it was in Worcester, Massachusetts, and like literally feeling like weeping, and watching this individual wake up the next morning, you know, completely renewed with life. And so I think it just solidified my choice in our field. And I'm reminded of why we do what we do literally every single day.
I mean, I could not agree with you more. You know, obviously coming from a more junior standpoint, but having recently, you know, been on procurements and whatnot through training, you know, you're sitting there and being a part of a transplant start to finish from the procurement to the implant, and just kind of like walking out and be like, did that really just happen? Like it's literally amazing. You know, I don't really know how else to even put it. And we kind of, I feel like sometimes we chalk it up to it's, you know, numbers and we did this many transplants. But if you think about like every single one of those is saving a life, and it's doing something that, frankly, I don't even know how it's possible sometimes.
It's so, again, this is this portal to something that's so beyond us. And I think that I love being struck by awe. There's like data on how, when you're in nature, you're struck by awe, right? There's this, the word awesome comes from that. And I think that's what this is every single day. And I think we're selfishly, I feel like I get to live a richer, fuller life because of it.
So, pivoting slightly, something that you mentioned a little bit, why do you think that trainees are not going into heart failure as much per the numbers? And what do you think? I know that there's been a lot of strides to kind of combat that. What are your thoughts on kind of the progression over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I think it's such a pivotal, important topic. And so many people opine in different ways. We've done surveys. I ask every trainee possible. I think, at its core, if I have to be honest, there are two fundamental aspects. I don't really think it's because people are going into critical care as much as people think that's one of the main reasons. I really think it's that trainees are given exposure to us during our busiest times, when we're seeing the sickest patients, when we are the most exhausted and most is demanded of us, and when it seems like we don't have any kind of balance with our personal lives. And I think that that is so unfair to them. And that's why I'm a really, really big proponent and advocate of them being exposed to us in the outpatient setting, to see the successes, to see how people are thriving, living their daily lives, not just crashing in the ICU and being put on ECMO. And of course, that has this, the quote unquote thrill of it. And I don't mean to sound flippant or irreverent, but that's just maybe 10% of what we do, and if it was all that we did, we would be, disenchanted with it as well. So I think we don't give a fair exposure to what it is that we do, coupled with the fact that, reimbursements are, similar because of how it had been set up for decades now, really, as non-invasive cardiologists. So from a trainee perspective, you're seeing people who are exhausted during your week on service, and you're seeing, okay, Dr. Lalo's on service. She looks exhausted. She's taking phone calls from her kids. She's trying to manage it all. It's 6 o'clock. She's still here. And I wonder how much she's getting paid. Is she getting paid as much as my other attending who's sitting and chilling in the echo lab and leaving at 5? And so I think when that's what you're taking in, it doesn't seem that appealing, quite frankly. So I think one of the very like tangible ways we can make a difference is diversifying and broadening our exposure for trainees during their training. And then we have to advocate. We really need to collectively have societal backup in terms of advocating for better reimbursement for what we do, because it is more time consuming. It is more complicated.
And all the discussions that you're having, these multidisciplinary discussions, like that's not, you're not being compensated for that. But that's sometimes the hardest part of it is, getting on the phone with a bunch of people or getting in a room with a bunch of people, talking at selection committee, all these things. And those are difficult discussions. And that really, that's almost like on your own time in a sense. But I think that you make an excellent point about, the variety of exposures, right? Because the general ACGME kind of training pathway and residency, and you might be staffing the CCU, or you might be taking care of, the heart failure for patients, the VADs that are coming in with driveline infections or GI bleeds or whatnot. And that's kind of like the tip of the iceberg that you see. But you don't see the person that got a VAD and has never been back in the hospital, that's doing everything that they want to do. Or you don't see the the transplant coming in with either rejection or infections. You see the ones you wouldn't even recognize them on the streets. Sometimes they come back. My favorite is when they'll come back to the ICU and they'll walk around and you'll see this and you're like, is this a family member? And you're like, oh my gosh, that's so so I took care of them. They were on ECMO. You know, they look completely normal. Totally. Put on weight. They look fantastic. They're telling you that they're exercising. They're spending all this time with their kids and their grandkids and their great, you know, all these things. And you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But we don't really, if that exposure isn't built in to the current system. And I think that when you look at a lot of the folks that have kind of decided on heart failure from an early stage, you know, myself as an example, like I was on a research block and I got to go down to the cath lab as like an intern at Penn State with John Boehmer. And we were doing LVAD ramp studies and biopsies. And I was just like, oh, I don't even know where the cath lab is. And he's like, okay, like get access. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so nervous. And he's like, okay, you did good job with that. Why don't you float the swan? You know, I'm right here for help. And then, you know, we started doing biopsies and, you know, the fourth biopsy, he hands me the biopsy and he's like, okay, you're up. And I was like, what?
An int?
Yeah. So it was like August of my PGY 2 year. So right at the end.
Wow. And
I didn't even realize like the gravity of that, because then I went to fellowship and they were like, oh, you know, you need to like, you know, do a bunch of these. And I was like, I've done some, but I don't know like how to tell you that, like, and I haven't done them with you, and you know, obviously all these things. But that early exposure to that side of it, you know, the procedural side for me was super fun, and the hemodynamics, and you know, now that's like basically like my I have a lot of favorite things in life and in heart failure, but hemodynamics is probably right up at the top. And, you know, that's not the stuff that you're seeing on a day-to-day basis, just in the CCU and, you know, taking care of like these really, 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 really sick patients, and some of them don't make it, and that takes a lot out of you. So right. I think you make a fantastic point about that. So let's shift gears a little bit. Back to kind of your career. And so that early faculty transition. So when you left Brigham, talk to me a little bit about that, you know, whether it was, you know, kind of finding the right job, or if you knew the job, you know, how did you navigate that transition? What were things that you did good or well, or, you know, and not so well?
Yeah, thanks. You know, when I left NYU, I loved every NYU, and it still feels like family, literally. My program director, Barry Rosenzweig, is who I call my academic dad. And I just saw him 2 weeks ago. And so when I was leaving NYU, there was this feeling of like, well, why did I choose another fellowship? Like, I'm 6 years into training. Like, I should have just taken a job here. They were offering me one. I could have worked in the CCU. I could have helped with program director stuff, which I knew I always loved. And so I had this intense remorse, actually, the June before I went to fellowship. And then it was very much like, okay, I'm going to do this and I'm going to come back here. So it was that mentality. And when I was at the Brigham, I interviewed everywhere. And I really am so grateful that I did that, because I got so much more exposure to other programs and other individuals in our community. It's so incredible that I got to meet so many people. But I ultimately decided to come back to NYU, which was at that time, a DT VAD only program, and that to a small one. Like, they were doing like 10, 12 VADs a year. This is back then. And when I started, and the people were incredible. It was Stu Katz, Alex Rantovich, like just the most amazing clinicians, thinkers, intellectuals, et cetera. I loved the people. And that never changed, but I missed transplant, and I missed being involved in kind of like larger research enterprise activity that was transplant related and like, you know, heart failure related. I was fortunate because I would travel back up to Boston, and I kept working with Mandeep and Lynn on a number of projects through the Heart Failure Apprentice Network and other things. So I felt like connected in that respect. But at that particular time, it wasn't the right fit for me. Now, of course, you know, NYU is like this insane powerhouse. So I don't want to be debasing. If anything, I'm indebted and always will be to NYU and speak really, really highly of it everywhere I go. But at that time, Mount Sinai felt like a more right fit. I think that's the right way to say it. And Yeah, so I moved here end of 2015, and yeah, have been here ever since. And I think, you know, what that taught me was it was so, it at the time was so heartbreaking to me. We had had our first baby, our daughter. So I was like this new attending, a new mom, and I had expected for everything to have fallen into place. You know, you're done with training, you finally get a job, and it's supposed to just roll out and be easy from there. And it was anything but. In fact, anybody who knows, and you can attest to this, your first year as an attending is perhaps the most difficult of all, because the buck stops with you. You have to make all the right decisions for yourself. You have to really learn what it means to try and establish a different balance every day with your personal life. You know, I don't like the word balance because it's like static. It's a balancing act that we are doing every single day, and it changes from day to day, right? But I think that learning that you have to constantly be in touch with yourself as to what is working, what is not, what is changeable, what is not, and then be very thoughtful about what your next steps are. You know, how much of it is external versus internal, right? And how much of it needs to be addressed via changing the external versus really kind of adapting on the internal. So I think that was the one of the pivotal experiences that reminded me how important it was to check in with myself. And really kind of almost write down, you know, nowadays people are looking to AI to serve as like their therapists, and it's remarkable actually when you can like ask questions and say like, what should I do in this scenario? But at that time I was really writing that down for myself, like what would be right for me, what would be wrong, you know, what would not be best for me. And so, you know, I happened to move to Sinai, still maintaining deep loving relationships, ones of respect and admiration for those who trained me, but this ended up being a fit that has worked out over the past decade plus. But you know, for anyone who's listening, who's navigating that transition, I think, you know, be kind to yourself and befriend yourself in the process, and also allow for the freedom for that first decision not necessarily to be the decision that is right for you at a later point, you know? Yeah, those are the three things I would take away from that.
That's really good advice. So now Sinai, it's just over 10 years, right?
Yeah, I just finished 11.
Oh wow, congratulations. So what roles have you taken on in your institution, and how have those changed over the years, and kind of what are your current and future goals there?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was really, really fortunate. I stepped into an amazing position where I was supported by the Department of Population Health Science by virtue of working with the Cardiothoracic Surgical Trials Network, which is funded by the NHLBI. And so I had, you know, research time and clinical time in the heart failure transplant and VAD service. And that afforded me a little bit of that like intellectual freedom to kind of pursue research. I continued to work with the Heart Failure Apprentice Network with Lynn and others, which was really nice. That's how I met Rob, but I'm sure we'll come to that when we talk about JCF. I knew that I wanted to establish a clinical trials program in heart failure and transplant research here at Sinai. And Sean Pinney, who I've known since I was an intern, who has been a really fierce advocate for me and confidant and friend, was like, do it. I'll support you. Go for it. I want you to create this and it'll be great. And so I hired one half of a research coordinator. And we started a clinical trials program. And we started with like registries. Revival, you know, some of like smaller studies that I knew I just wanted to do two or three trials, but really be like a top enroller to prove ourselves, establish some sort of framework for what was needed. And now we've grown you know, to enrolling in 18 clinical trials and having 5 full-time coordinators. And, you know, hopefully, you know, sponsors see us as a site that's reliable and invested and interested. I think from a clinical trials perspective, it's a win-win all around, right? It's incredible for patient care. It's incredible for the section from a faculty, APP, trainee perspective. And you get to contribute to our advancement and understanding of how to take care of patients. It's like, I don't think there's a greater privilege. And then I have to really shout out to Mona Fazuad and Chris O'Connor, who through the Heart Failure Collaboratory developed this clinical trial intern program. And so we've had interns who have served as research coordinators and also been involved in HFC activity, which has been incredibly gratifying. I'm actually writing a letter for one of them probably this week. But that, the opportunity to engage with individuals and hopefully ignite a passion for research at that level has also been really, really rewarding, and not necessarily along the conventional path of like med student to resident to fellow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a little bit about how I've evolved, I think, at Sinai. I think the other thing I would say is that I really sought to take advantage of what Sinai had to offer with respect to leadership development. And I would encourage anybody who's listening to do that too and find out what your institution has, because everyone has something. So we had a program, this was like at the end of my third year, I believe, here, called LEAD, which was originally, I think, an NIH-funded program that was year-long, and it was individuals from all different kinds of disciplines, and we had lessons and exposure to coaching and conflict resolution and negotiations and emotional intelligence and self-discovery. And it was a year-long program, and it was so transformative for me, because I felt invested in, and like that third year mark is where you finally get the hang of getting your notes in on time and being able to make clinical decisions without second guessing and third guessing yourself. But then you're kind of looking for something more. You're like, okay, now what? And that was that time. And I think programs like that really mitigate burnout, because they show you that the institution is invested in you and your evolvement and evolution. And you are able to, you have carved out time to better yourself, for lack of a better way of saying it. And I was exposed to like just incredible coaches and mentors and all these people that existed across the institution that weren't just in cardiology, but that I was able to interact with. And that was so, so priceless for me. So I really, really am grateful to Sinai for that. And then, you know, things kind of evolved from there. So the research program, then I became program director of the Heart Failure Fellowship, which has been and continues to be such a fulfilling aspect of what I'm afforded to be able to do. And then, you know, I would say in general, I have felt really supported. Like when I talk about what it means to find a job after fellowship, and I think you and I have talked about this too, there's like, you have to figure out what your non-negotiables are, you know, like, is it your commute? Is it the salary support? Is it what you actually get to do? Is it the exposure to mentorship, research time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so for me, the commute's never been ideal, because I live in, I can't really say Jersey, but I say across the river from New York City. Not that I don't have pride, but yeah, it's taking me a while. But I have felt supported and I have felt acknowledged. And I think that that's so, so important. So that's a little bit about how I've kind of moved along in the, at least at Sinai.
So I guess the, not to call it the elephant in the room, but I've been waiting to take a sip out of my JCF mug here. Tell us about how JCF started, your involvement in the journal, you know, some of where you've taken it. I know that we could do a whole separate discussion just on that. So give me the highlights there.
Yeah, you'll have to cut me off if I'm talking too long. So I think you can see I'm smiling from ear to ear because that has been such a gift. And I'm largely indebted to my dear friend Rob for this, Rob Mentz. I remember him calling. So Rob, just taking this back, we met as heart failure fellows in 2013 through the Heart Failure Network, and then we formed this Heart Failure Apprentice Network, where we started doing ancillary studies of these larger trials that were done by our mentors across different institutions. So it was like our first exposure to what it would feel like to be a part of like a research consortium as fellows. And we, hit it off right away. Rob is just such a magnanimous person. Obviously, you know this as well. Aside from his insane brilliance. And we had stayed in touch over the years and worked on a couple of things together. We always saw each other at conferences and kind of cheered each other on, regardless of where we were. But he called me, I think this was September of 2020, and he was like, "Hey, I'm going to go for this editor-in-chief position, and I'd love for you to be a part of the team if I'm selected." And I shared like, "Okay, these are what I'm thinking, other commitments, et cetera, et cetera." But I remember him sharing a slide set, and I remember being so incredibly obsessed with thinking about this. And I was like, "Oh my God, we could do this, we could do that, we could do this, we could," like, to the point where it was like, as my daughter would say, extra. I was in the shower, I was thinking about it before I was sleeping, I was thinking about it. I was like, "Oh my God, what's that?" And I like, and he was just, even in that like pie in the sky, just floating ideas phase, he was so receptive. I think that's one of his superpowers. He's such a good listener. And he was like, "Yeah, I like that. Let's do this, let's do that." Like, and none of it was real. And but just having that forum to be able to exchange ideas so freely, where things just flow, is such a gift when that happens between any two individuals. And then, of course, not surprisingly, he was chosen to be the next editor in chief, and he asked me to be his deputy editor. And at the time, I may not have on paper been the obvious choice, with respect to prior publications and, maybe gravitas, or maybe it was just me feeling like imposter syndrome. But the faith and the trust that he placed in me and in our friendship, and I think more importantly, in our the easy flow of exchange of ideas, was so amazing. It was just such an exhilarating experience. And then the rest is history. I think we were very clear on the fact that we wanted to build community first and foremost. We wanted to add freshness to this journal, but really use the journal as a platform for building and connecting people. And that was, I mean, it has been such an incredible gift that there are really no words to describe it. It has been and continues to be one of the greatest joys of my professional and, quite frankly, personal lives.
Yes, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. JCF has been such a large part of my early career and my life in general. As you say, bringing people together. I think that that's basically how we would have met in the heart failure spheres, regardless. But JCF really brought it home, to become a family. And I think that it's really done that. And I think everything that you guys set out to do has been accomplished, and even more. I think it's been fantastic to see, for both from the outside looking in, and also from the inside. And I think that it's so welcoming, and it's not just within people that are on the board. Really, it's everybody that's involved with the journal, anybody that submits to the journal, anybody that's in heart failure, anybody that's even outside of heart failure and just in medicine. There's overlap, and now branching out to JCF intersections and really being deliberate with breaking down barriers. I think that that's one of the themes, is that it's been like, well, we want to do this, and someone's like, no, and it's like, well, why? And it's like, there's no real reason. It's like, okay, well, let's just figure out a way to make things happen for the better. And I think that you and Rob have been so deliberate with those changes, and it's just been amazing. That's my two cents, in case you were wondering.
Thank you. And I feel like it's really such a collective effort. You've been a part of it. So many have been a part of it. And it's, I think, has been such a learning process as well as learning along the way, like from our mistakes and for things that we haven't done right, not, of course, intentionally, but perhaps inadvertently. And so I think being open and honest and humble in the process has been so gratifying. And I just pray that we're able to continue to do it.
Yeah, and now you're co-editor in chief.
Yeah, I mean, that isn't, that's also like another example of, just I think his open-mindedness. But he at one point was like, as deputy editor, you're doing like half of what I'm doing, and we have such different strengths. And they're complementary. And he's like, I'd really like for you to be acknowledged as such. And I remember saying, like, it's not so much that I want to be acknowledged for the work, but I really love what message that puts out for our community. It shows that you can defy conventional norms. And you can share in leadership, and you can share credit, and you can share responsibility in a way that's public-facing and humble and honest and magnanimous. And I think it's a really beautiful thing. I really was really proud to be a part of that effort. And I have to credit also Meredith Hurt, who's just insanely gifted at what she does.
Literally amazing.
And and all of the HFSA board and whatnot. I mean, it's a village, but it's been and is an honor.
And I think that, JCF has really, it's become almost an institution in its own, not just a journal, and really a home for everybody in heart failure, both from a trainee standpoint and, building relationships and networks and mentorship. I think that some of the endeavors that you've taken on, for example, the mentorship program with reviewing and kind of building that. We always hear about how it's hard to get people, hard to get good reviews or timely reviews and everything like that. And I think that you guys have taken that head on, and also with the early involvement in fellows in the board and to help broadcast the message. Really, I've been fortunate to be a part of that. It really is kind of like a almost life-changing in a sense for some of these early opportunities that people get. And I've heard, and I'm not just saying this for myself, I've heard this from multiple people, and but I can name, like dozens of friendships that have been built just because we've worked together on papers through JCF. We all meet at conferences and whatnot, and now we have these, these write-ups that you can go and look back to and remember, oh, that's right. I remember talking about a paper not too long ago, and I was like, oh, I know we've written about this. Let me just go find the exact summary, because these were the thoughts that were, cultivated by a number of different authors and all these things. So I again want to applaud you and Rob and the whole team for taking all of this on. And it's just continuing to build the network and bringing more people into the community and facilitating amazing experiences.
Oh, I mean, well, thank you. And I think, it's a process, and it's such a huge team effort, I think. It's also just like a really nice example of when people come together with the idea of building something good for others and bigger than any one individual. Like, life is magical, right? Like, it really is. And so it's nice to be a part of something like that. And I think it's going to be tricky to continue to evolve in this space and see how we can do things differently. I think it's really wonderful to see some of the programs that have been initiated through the JCF platform now being seen elsewhere, and so you feel like, okay, cool, this is catching on, that we can democratize these processes and we can be transparent about what it means to be on an editorial board, et cetera. So as things evolve, we'll have to continue to be nimble and innovate and that's a part of the fun.
Yep. Yeah, it's been amazing to see, and I can't wait to see what the next, you know, the next thing is. And you know, I'm sure on your end it sometimes feels like an obstacle, but I think for the field, you know, everybody can agree that it's brought life and energy into the, you know, the next round of trainees, and now moving into early career and different stages in your career. And I think that that's been great. And it kind of brings me to my next point, which is mentorship. And I think that that's been built in through JCF, but I'm curious to hear your take. I know you've been a mentor to me and so many of my colleagues from a trainee perspective. Tell me a little bit about your mentors, you know, what you've taken from them and how you translate that into, you know, becoming a mentor yourself for your mentees.
Yeah, I don't know if I like necessarily consider myself a mentor yet. Maybe you just never lose.
Well, I do. So,
no, I mean, I don't mean to put it in, put myself down, but I think you almost always think of yourself as just an ongoing learner, like a lifelong learner, which doesn't have to be mutually exclusive of becoming a mentor, of course. I think, you know, and this isn't unique to me, but you are. So like you are the product of so many different individuals. I mean, I can remember this incredible physician I had as a third year med student, Vijay Rajput, who just transformed the way I thought and taught. And I was like, wow, this is amazing. And then people in residency and then in fellowship and then heart failure fellowship, et cetera. So I feel like I can name several people who have had profound influence over me. I think that's the key, is to not try and look for everything that you need in one individual, because otherwise you're setting yourself up for failure. And rather look to see what can be most readily gleaned from one individual and take in what you want from that. Let's say, like, I love the way one person teaches. Okay, great. I'm going to take that part in, make it my own. And then maybe I love the way another person writes. And so I'm going to take that part in and make it my own. And then I love the way another person speaks. And I take that. And I think it has taken me a long time to fully embrace and recognize that, because the conventional understanding of a mentor is, okay, I'm going to get everything I need out of you. I want to be like you. I want to talk like you. I want to write like you. I want to teach like you. And I want to see patients like you. And I don't think that that's the right way to go about doing things. And it doesn't mean that you only get one thing from one person. It may be two things. It may be three things. But I think keeping your mind open is so, so important, because ultimately you have to forge your own path. And ultimately, you're never going to be exactly like any one individual. You're only going to be the best version of yourself, or at least that's the objective. And so I think there's so much to learn from so many different people. I am indebted to, I can't even begin to name, but certainly Sean Pinney at Sinai, Barry Rosenzweig, Judy Hochman, Alex Rantovich at NYU, amongst many others. I can go on and on. Lynn, for sure. Stevenson at Brigham, really. I happened to be the only fellow that year because the second fellow dropped out a week before we started. And so while I did a lot more call than I originally anticipated, et cetera, it was like a blessing, really, because I got so much one-on-one exposure with all the attendings at the Brigham who were just unbelievable. Anju Noria, Akshay Desai, Garrick Stewart, Neil Lechtawala, Michael Giverts, and Mandeep also, I have to say, was just so inspirational and took so much time with fellows and invested in me. And I really am so indebted to everybody there for that. And then I think it goes on and on extramurally, like people like Clyde Yancey and people like I can go on and on. But for me, that has been the primary take home, is learn from different aspects of people and try to emulate things that resonate with you. And then make your own path, make your own model of what it means to be a quote unquote mentor for somebody or to somebody else.
Well, I hope, you know, I think that that's that theme is very much in line with this podcast, which is basically to talk with a lot of people, hear about how they got here. And so for the listeners, that they can take certain bits of advice, you know, what one person says might be less or more relevant for, you know, for the individual. And I think that you know, these insights are so valuable. And so that's why I appreciate your time and everybody else's time that's come on so far. And, you know, we're kind of rounding up towards the end here. So I want to chat about some more fun stuff a little bit. So tell me about sports.
Can I see one? Oh, God, sports. Don't even, Alex. Can I go back really, really quick?
Yes.
One that came
I would
up.
Love you too.
We had this like women in cardiology session at Sinai for residents and med students last week. And I shared one thing that I'm working on as a person. And that I didn't have as much appreciation for earlier on, which is the power of peer mentors and for trainees as sources of advice and feedback. And I think, to be very honest and frank, like oftentimes my ego would hold me back from, let's say I gave a talk and then for me to go to you and say, hey, Alex, how was that? I don't know if I had the strength to hear if you were like, well, I've heard you speak better, you know, but I, what my prayer moving forward is to be more open to that. And you know, someone who does this really well, who's inspired me, is Jeff Barnes. Like, he'll give a talk and then he'll be like, what do you think I could do differently or better? And this comes from the emerging faculty course at the ACC, which was also transformative. And I was so moved by it because I was like, you crushed it, you know, usual, the super, like, superficial stuff that we say. And he really is an amazing speaker. But he was like, no, what could I improve upon? And it really caught me off guard. And I said, wow, like, not only is that an incredible question, but how humble and open do you have to be to ask that? And if really put to it, I think I would be extremely constructive and he would be very constructive to me. And same thing with Rob or you or Andrew or, you know, anybody. I think your peers actually really know you well and they've seen you evolve over this time period. So I think one of my prayers moving forward is to be more open and receptive to peer mentor advice and also trainee advice. Like, what do you think I could have done better this week? And so that's something I'm working on. So I just wanted to touch on that.
I think that that's fantastic. I mean, feedback is such a large part of medical training, but asking for feedback and dealing with feedback is a challenge. And I think that that's something that we're all still learning how to navigate, you know, life, as you mentioned, lifelong learning, right? I mean, no one wants to hear negative feedback. That's human nature. But you understand, once you take a step back, is that that's going to help you way more than keep doing what you're doing, keep reading, you know, you're doing great. Oh, you're amazing. All these things, like, that doesn't make you better. What makes you better is I remember one of my best mentors in residency sat me down after we did a week together and I thought I did great. And she's like, I expected so much more out of you. And I was heartbroken. I was like a mess. I was like, oh my gosh. I worked my butt, you know, I didn't think that I was, you know, but she mentioned a couple key things and I was like, you know, okay. Yeah. I think I can do it there. And I worked my butt off to fix those things. And she's like, listen, I'm being hard on you, like, on purpose. And I'm like almost in tears. And it's, as you mentioned, you know, figuring out like how to improve.
Yeah. It's, I think, you know, we should never shy away from that, and I'm working on it myself.
Okay. So I know you laughed about the sports things, and I just bring it up because we poke fun and things like that. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe that you may have won an NCAA bracket even.
Oh,
you're clearly a sports savant.
Very, very sporty. My husband says the fact that you say you're sporty is just so illustrative of how not sports oriented you are.
I think that there's a lot of folks in our field that love sports and everything like that. And then it's just so funny to see, you being so far away from it, but obviously have so much in common with everybody else that, it just kind of works itself out. And it's almost
Totally.
like, I think from the outside looking in, myself as obviously like a huge avid sports fanatic, it's almost like it's like you're the kid in the candy shop of like being exposed to something for the first time, and then like I get to witness that like just pure joy and excitement and kind of like what's this and what's that, and you could get to explain things to you and all these things, and I know you've been going to more sports games and everything like that, and obviously supporting your husband, and it's fantastic to see, because obviously I
Our son. Oh.
So what else, wrapping up here, what else do you like to do for fun, on your downtime?
Yeah, I think, one thing that we didn't get to touch on, which is crazy, it's been an hour, so I don't want to bore our listeners, but is, this desire to kind of feel harmony with what I did at work and how I lived at home. And oftentimes, of course, we've talked about how satisfying it is to see people at these really vulnerable intersections of their lives and all the things that we do as heart function docs. But I feel like have gleaned this incredible appreciation for the urgency of prevention and practicing a healthy lifestyle. And that sounds trite, but it's so real because when you're raising a family, when you're watching your parents age, when you want your partner and friends to stay healthy, these are the things that you're thinking about, like how much exercise should I be doing? What should I be eating? How many cocktails are too many cocktails? Like all these little things that, of course we know how to give advice in the clinic, but now it's like, okay, what works for me? What kind of care do I want? And what would I advocate for the people that I love? And that and I've been influenced deeply by people like Martha and Pam Taub and others to help me appreciate the urgency of prevention. And so I'm really loving the fact that Heart Function is recognizing that prevention is our lane, especially as if things have changed from the cardio kidney metabolic space to that effect. And so we're, and I know you asked me what was fun, so I don't mean to be exceedingly boring, but this is what led me to pursue an integrative medicine fellowship, which is what I'm in right now, which is allowing me to appreciate. Not that I want to be, an advocate for what's called an alternative medicine, but what I want to do is understand the walks of life that people are coming from, what people are seeking in quote unquote good health, and how I can serve as a bridge between misconceptions, evidence-based, and then perhaps things that are not harmful, but rather helpful and deeply personal, like mind-body exercises and things like that. So that's been really exciting and fun for me. I love yoga. I love dancing, in all its forms. And I just adore and treasure the time with my family and my friends. Ultimately, I think that's what a deep, full life is about, is the connections that we get to have, not only with others, but then in turn with ourselves as well.
I think that you have really done a great job of separating things out too. Is, when the weekend is family time, I'm not doing work or whatnot. And I remember actually emailing you probably a couple of years now, probably something related to JCF. And you're like, I'm off the grid this weekend, doing X, Y, and Z, whatever. I won't get to this until this date. And that like and I remember taking a step back and being like, this is it's so like helpful to see other people actually doing it, because I feel like everybody talks about it and creating boundaries and whatnot, but then everybody just says yes to everything and is always busy and whatnot. And I think that very you've really been an advocate for that of when I'm home and I'm with family, like I'm not doing other things, and I'm gonna be
Thank
present with
God.
that.
I'm certainly trying, and it changes from day to day, but thank you for saying that. And it's an ongoing pursuit, right? It's an ongoing balancing act like we talked about. And I think, again, it goes back to what we talked about earlier in this hour, is so much of it is, have I connected with myself? Have I checked in with myself and what I need at this moment to allow my best self to come forward to the extent feasible.
You know, and you mentioned something too with the integrative medicine and prevention and whatnot. And Martha made a great point when she came on is meeting people where they are, right? Because you can sit here and talk on the podium at ACC and whatnot about trials and people should be doing this. But frankly, like the people aren't sitting in the audience there. They're not reading the primary articles. They're not reading the news articles about the primary literature, you know, the social navigating social media, you know, talking with patients and meeting them on their level, you know, is super helpful because frankly, you know, we say like the best medicine is the one they're going to take, right? You know, you can tell them to do X, Y, and Z, but if they're not going to do any of it, you know, then you got to figure out a different way to make it happen.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
So, okay. So last thing, if you were to tell something to your younger self, what would it be?
Oh, I love that question. I think I would tell my younger self to, you know, Anu, be who you are unapologetically. And that's who I'd say. Because I think when you come forth with your best, fullest self, like the world ends up a better place because you're unabashedly, authentically you. And there's no one else like you in this world. And I don't know why this is still a process. It's not like I'm like that now, but that's what I would tell my younger self. So maybe I could have gotten more of a head start. But there's something really beautiful about people just being who they are and not always conforming into different, you know, shapes and sizes that have been defined, you know, arbitrarily. So I would say be yourself unapologetically. And I would say that what is clear to me above all else is that how we interact with people and ourselves is what determines the quality of our lives. And so I think you're never too young to hear that. And my poor kids, they're like only 9 and 12, but they hear these kinds of like big lofty ideals all the time. But I truly believe that because when you love yourself, you are more loving and compassionate to others. And in that, you'll never be, I don't think you'll ever make quote unquote wrong decisions when you have that kind of mentality, like that true golden rule. Like one of our ed page for June, which is coming out next week, is just about this. Like literally it's that simple, like treat others the way you want to be treated. That's what it'd say.
Well, that's awesome. You know, this has been such a fantastic chat. I hope you've enjoyed your time as much as I have. I've learned so much and I already know you and I'm learning things, you know, every minute here. So, thank you again. I think that it's been such a great, pleasure having you, as a guest on the podcast. And I hope the listeners are able to take away some good bits of advice and you know to fulfill their careers and their lives and you know live with you know give yourself grace and all the themes that we've mentioned. I think that there's been recurring themes on all the chats that we've had, but this was fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex. It's such a pleasure and honor to be able to speak like candidly and vulnerably. Yes. And lovingly, yes. Especially what we do day to day. So thank you.
Thank you so much. That wraps up another episode of Moving the Needle in Medicine. Thank you for joining us. I want to also thank Dr. Anu Lala for sharing her insights, experiences, and perspective on the evolution of cardiovascular medicine, scientific innovation, and mentorship. If you enjoyed this conversation, be sure to subscribe to Moving the Needle in Medicine on HCP Live, YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. For more conversations with the clinicians, researchers, and leaders helping shape the future of medicine, visit hcplive.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.